habemus papam.
We have a new pope. Cardinal Robert Francis Prevost is Leo XIV, the 267th Roman pontiff. Who is Pope Leo? And what issues will he need to address as he embarks on the pontificate? The papal posse, Father Gerald Murray and Robert Royal, are here with analysis.
La pace sia con tutti voi.
And later, Bishop Robert Barron shares his thoughts on the new pope. Plus, President Emeritus of the Acton Institute, Father Robert Sirico, is here. The world over, from the Vatican, begins right now.
Now, Raymond Arroyo.
Buonasera, a warm welcome to all of you joining us in the United States and the world over. An important show for you this week as we celebrate the election of Pope Leo XIV. If you'd like to comment on the show, send me a post. I'm at Raymond Arroyo. I'm also at Arroyo Grande Show on YouTube. On May 8th, right here, the world witnessed the first appearance of Cardinal Robert Francis Prevost as Pope Leo XIV. This after only four ballots. He is the first ever American pope. And without further ado, I'm joined by the papal posse, editor-in-chief of the CatholicThing.org, Robert Royal, and canon lawyer and priest of the Archdiocese of New York, Father Gerald Murray. Thank you both for being here. Father, and then Bob, your thoughts on when you saw Pope Leo appear here, and we were all here watching, when you saw an American was announced, you thought what?
I was very surprised because I was of the opinion no American will ever get elected pope.
Like the rest of
exactly.
us.
Exactly. So I kind of, like, stereotypical thinking was guilty of that. But, no, it was very beautiful to see him come out. He was wearing the traditional vestments. He gave a good message. Yeah. And then he gave a very traditional blessing of the pope as the new pope. I was very pleased with that.
Yeah. Bob?
Well, I was in the crowd here, and everybody was just going absolutely wild. I heard the name come in over my cell phone, and all of a sudden, not only were the people you would expect cheering him, I heard a bunch of Italians say, "Il Papa Americano." So it was a shock that it was him, and it was a shock that it was so soon. But I think we're all settling into the idea, and it's a new moment in the church, that's for sure.
Well, look, Prevost was just made a cardinal by Pope Francis in 2023, and he became prefect of the Dicastery of Bishops just in that window in the last 2 years. So my question, Father, why do you think the College of Cardinals shifted toward a man who was really, talk about the periphery, he was on the periphery of candidates. I mean, what happened to Parolin and Tagle, do you think?
Well, my guess is that he was able to attract a different voting blocks because of his background. So, first of all, he was definitely someone that Pope Francis liked and appreciated because he brought him here from Chiclayo in Peru, made him the prefect of the Dicastery for Bishops, and then made him a cardinal. Yeah. And he got much favor, I think, from Pope Francis. Yeah. Secondly, he's a North American who is identified himself as a South American because he became a Peruvian citizen when he was named Bishop of Chiclayo. So he could appeal to both ends of the American continent. And then as a missionary and a religious order priest, he would appeal to many people throughout the world because missionaries are one of the glories of the church, that they leave their home country to go preach the gospel.
So he covers a lot of bases.
Yes.
Cardinal Prevost is an Augustinian priest now, Leo. An order dedicated to the rule of St. Augustine and founded in 1244. Bob, what does that Augustinian tradition and spirituality tell you about the mind, the style, and soon the pontificate of Leo XIV?
Well, you know, one of the great terms in the theology of St. Augustine is the heart. Our hearts, he says, he at the beginning of his confessions, he says, "Our hearts are restless till they rest in thee." And so I think that there's a portion of that in almost every one of the Augustinians. My guess is that in his case here, he was also able to, he presents himself very, very well. He comes across as a mature, steady hand. He no doubt had lots of interactions when he was head of the office for naming bishops, and in that sense probably had not only had the geographic distribution that Father was talking about, but he actually had a personal interaction with a lot of the people who may eventually have voted for him. So he happened to be the right guy at the right intersection at the right time.
Yeah. Pope Leo's brother, John Prevost, who has been interviewed extensively over the last day or so, he's given us quite a bit of information about what kind of pope his brother might be, particularly regarding immigration and hot-button issues like same-sex marriage. Take a look.
I think you'll see a second Pope Francis, I think. I don't want to speak for him, but I think he sees the United States is headed in the wrong direction in terms of immigration. That this is a total injustice. These are people. Doesn't matter where they're born. They are people first. And so they need to be treated as people first. The war, it's got to be, I don't know how he would handle that. It's a very difficult situation because you're going to offend someone one way or the other no matter what. Gay marriage, did you say? I think he will follow what the church has traditionally said about that, I think.
Father, he indicates that his brother's very much in line with Pope Francis. Do you entirely buy that?
In some ways he is, but other ways he isn't. I mean, I'll remind our viewers that he is a canon lawyer. Pope Leo XIV studied canon law at the Angelicum University, and he taught canon law for 10 years in Peru as a professor at the Augustinian Seminary. Now, I'm a canon lawyer, so I'm kind of prejudiced in favor of fellow canon lawyers.
Are you running for the next pope? Is that what you're doing here?
No, I'm just running checking. To be on the papal posse. That's good enough.
You have an esteemed spot forever.
Well, thank you.
Don't you worry.
How do you like the hat, by the way?
I love the hat. And I have a matching one that I didn't wear.
Oh,
I forgot.
Too bad.
Bob, your reaction to the brother's comments that there's a problem in the country vis-a-vis immigration, that's not the pope's job.
Yeah, and I think whatever the Pope says about immigration, we know in the United States and also in Europe that it's just a crisis of how large a wave of illegal immigrants have come in that disrupt the society, and that's not going to basically go
including
anywhere.
Here in Italy.
Yeah, but I'm intrigued by the way he's gone back and chosen the name Leo XIV, which takes us back to the very beginnings of modern Catholic social thought. So he's got that sort of forwarded in his own name, and it'll be interesting to see. I hope he does not take a kind of a Latin American liberation theology turn or this sort of tercer mundismo that really focuses on the poor as explaining something about the world, but as an American brings a new perspective to Rome.
Father, at only 69 years old, Pope Leo is relatively young among the College of Cardinals, and though American by birth, he spent, as we've been discussing, the bulk of his life and missionary work in Peru. He was a bishop there, later becoming a bishop. And he has a mathematics background from his undergrad time at Villanova, as well as a doctorate in canon law, which you referenced. Your thoughts on how that particular educational background and the mind of a canon lawyer might focus this pontificate on issues and problems that we've been discussing for the last 12 years.
Sure. Well, I'll say this. He looks like he's in great physical shape. I know he's a tennis player, so I hope he's able to find some tennis courts. There are courts at the North American College.
Oh, at the college.
So maybe he'll be able to play there, but maybe he'll put one at Castel Gandolfo. Yeah. No, I think being a canon lawyer will help him in dealing with the crises and issues that always come across the papal desk. And Pope Francis really didn't have much regard for canon law. Just, we know that by the way he acted. He basically disregarded some of the laws. He issued what are called motu proprios, which are basically decrees. So rather than letting things take their course, he kind of intervened personally. I think Pope Leo is going to respect the canonical processes, which also include the department heads taking the lead on different issues and not simply everything having to go across the papal desk right from the beginning.
Bob and Father, I bet you have a thought on this too. Your thoughts on where Pope Leo should and how he should approach Pope Francis's ban on the old traditional Latin Mass. How urgent is that?
Well, it may not be something that he wants to do immediately because there's so much else that comes with becoming pope. But I think in the medium term, certainly within this first year, it would be a good thing for him to eliminate that ban, because it would bring back into the church a very growing and dynamic part of the church. It doesn't have to dominate the rest of the church. Lots of people go to the Novus Ordo Mass, and they're quite comfortable and they benefit from it. But to dismiss one of the parts of the church that is the most passionate and the most faithful to the church, I think it would be a mistake for him to continue that.
Worry to roll back that ban on the traditional Latin Mass and just return to what Benedict did, which is say, if a priest wants to say it, he can say it. What would that do to heal the divide between traditionalists and in the church that many
I think this is an easy win for him, because restoring the Latin Mass is simply going back to the situation that was under Pope Benedict, and which was very beneficial. Yeah. And I think for him, having people be grateful for him to doing something that facilitates their spiritual life, it fits in with his homily today at Mass, in which he talked about proclaiming Christ. Yeah. That really, people go to Latin Mass because they say, I feel closer to God at it. Yeah. Let them do that.
And the mystical, supernatural power of the Mass
is
more tangible. So they say. Maybe it is for some, but it is for them.
Yeah.
And that should be good enough. It's a Mass of the Ages. In his Urbi et Orbi address, Pope Leo, right after his election, expressed the following that may give us some insight into how he will continue this Petrine ministry post-Francis. Watch.
Dobbiamo cercare insieme come essere una chiesa missionaria.
Look at how we can together be a missionary church, a church that builds bridges, that is always open to receive everyone, just like in this square, to receive everyone, to welcome everyone, our charity, our dialogue and love.
We need to be a synodal church, a church that's a pilgrim, that shows charity always, and especially is charitable to those who are suffering.
Bob, some of that language there in line with Pope Francis, the echo of synodality, which made me clench just a bit, I won't lie. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, all of that is true, but I think when we heard those words during the Francis papacy, what was missing was kind of a sense of urgency about evangelization. Mm-hmm. You know, there's talk about it, but there doesn't just seem to be the desire to put a lot of energy in moving outward rather than talking internally with these synodal conversations that seem to go on and on forever. Mm. So, look, we know that the Pope Francis set up this synodal assembly that's supposed to take place in 2028. Mm. If that goes on, that'll be a long shadow from this papacy. And in June, we've got coming up the reports from these study groups that were left over after the October Synod this past year, and their reports are due in June. It'll be very interesting to see what Leo does with those. He may put them in his pocket for a while. He may tout them highly, and it'll give us an indication of how he's thinking concretely about synodality.
Do you want to have a comment about synodality?
Yeah, no, this will be one of the major indications of what direction the pontificate's going, because the synodality is still an unknown quantity.
Yeah, nobody knows what it
means.
And
it largely depended on what Pope Francis decided. You know, he decided this, and that the last decision was there's not going to be a synod in 2020. It's going to be an ecclesial assembly, which is going to include basically one-third bishops, one-third laity, one-third others, clergy and religious. That's at least what we're understanding it to be. This looks like an Anglican assembly. It looks like something that, you know, was invented in Canterbury. The Catholic Church does not consider lay people to be shepherds. Yeah. And this, if you put them in an assembly and vote to do this and that pastorally, that's undermining the hierarchy. The hierarchical structure of the church needs to be defended. I'm hoping that Pope Leo will modify this and put it back in line with what Paul VI did when he created the Synod of Bishops.
And for our non-Catholic viewers, that hierarchical church was not created by men.
Right.
It was created by Jesus Christ. He said, you 12, come here. I'm giving you the key. And then you all go out. This is it. I'm not taking everybody. I'm not taking all the disciples, just you
right.
all. That's the Lord's choice and prerogative. And now you have to follow through on that. You can't. I agree with you. I think we're going to see an adaptation of synodality. and a redefinition of it in the same way Pope Francis tried to redefine Vatican II and liturgy and many other things. Given the effusive praise we have seen, the enthusiasm from more progressive figures in the church like Austin Ivory and LGBT activist Father James Martin, who I saw the other day out here, do you see Pope Leo softening his former position? He is quoted as saying he had a difficulty with the homosexual lifestyle and people adopting children, gay couples adopting children. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, he's emphasized quite a bit the nature of the family, the natural and divine nature of the family, and just what human sexuality is for. So I'd be very surprised if, as a pope, he would go back on that. I would like to see him be especially wary, because this is not... Some people kind of think of this as a nice conversation with, you know, some Catholics who happen to be same-sex attracted. What he's really going to be facing is immense pressure by LGBT activists. And I think that Francis sometimes misunderstood that, and that in his sincere desire to reach out to people he believed were marginalized, didn't realize the kind of benefit he was giving to activists rather than just individual people.
Your thoughts on what we know so far about Pope Leo's thoughts on abortion? We know he's very pro-life. You even see that on his Twitter feed. And he's very worried about the power of media and how it's distorted and undermined the family and marriage.
Yeah, he also criticized gender ideology and its imposition, trying to convince children that there are more than male and female. Mm-hmm. No, I think what Bob's comments summarize very well the challenge that the Pope is facing. And by all indications, Pope Leo has been consistent in upholding church teaching in this matter. And then, we have to redefine the nature of charity. Charity is truth. Charity is not pretense. If we pretend and make believe that homosexual attraction is a natural occurrence that has to be supported, and that homosexual activity is equal to normal sexual activity, we're going down a dead end. It's contradicting the nature of revelation and natural law. So I don't think we're going to go down that route. But I know, as you say, there's an activist mob out there which is browbeating the Catholic Church to say homosexuality is equal to heterosexuality. It simply is not the case.
What should we be on the lookout for in the coming days as this pontificate begins, Bob? I mean, we've already seen in that opening mass, in his coming out party here, a very different look, at least, to the Pope we've become accustomed to over the last 12 years.
Well, it's going to be interesting, I think, to see how much he wants to be a media figure, because I don't know that it's always important for a pope to be a media figure. It's important for us to be media figures.
Yeah, that's right.
Of course. But if he can work solidly, maturely behind the scenes and really establish the church in a way that I've always thought we have tremendous teaching inside the church, but to bring that out to people even at the parish level, at the national level, that should be, at this moment in history, in my view, what a church leader should be doing. Not so much worrying about climate change and immigration and all those other things that we hear about. We've got to tend to the Catholic garden, and we've got to make sure that the people who are inside that with us are receiving the fullness of the faith.
And that Catholic garden is in trouble. We have to say that. Finances are in trouble. Ordinations are in trouble. Seminarians are in trouble. All those numbers are plumb line down, particularly over the last 12 years. I don't know if you've been hearing that, but that's the reality.
Yeah.
What must he address first?
I would say this. He should declare a moratorium on papal trips and spend the first year getting people together to figure out the finances of the Vatican. And this is one of the great things about having an American pope, because in the American and English-speaking world, there are a lot of very competent people who know how to do turnarounds. Mm. And, the Vatican deficit on pensions, for instance, that can be solved if you get good management together, identify your resources, and cut your costs. Mm-hmm. I think that requires a lot of attention. I hope he would do what Pope Francis did originally, get a figure like Cardinal Pell in, who brought in experts from Australia, and started not only uncover the assets, but decide we have to do something to invest these better. Mm. I would say papal trips are wonderful, but you show the seriousness. Let's get the house in order. We can pay for ourselves. Damn. Then we can do other things.
Chicago would probably disagree with you, but all my friends in Chicago, I'm with you. Okay, we will leave it there. Thank you, Posse. And look, if you want more of us, go to Arroyo Grande Show at YouTube for more daily updates. The Conclave crew, the three of us, dove into really the record of Pope Leo and what it will mean to the future. The latest episode is up. Thank you for being here.
Habemus Papam.
Joining me now with his thoughts and reflections on the election of Pope Leo XIV and his history of pastoral ministry in Peru is the founder of Word on Fire Ministries, the Bishop of Winona, Rochester, Bishop Robert Barron. Thank you so much
Raymond,
for being
good
here.
Good to be with you.
What a
always.
Joy to have you back. It's well, only been
you.
12 years since
right.
I had you here around
That's
the table.
Right.
We heard much in recent days about the diversity of this College of Cardinals, the expansion of the church in Africa, Asia, the peripheries. I don't think anybody imagined that these cardinals would look to the periphery of America
no.
to elect Robert Provost.
I sat
Leo
right here a few days ago with Colin Flynn and going over candidates, and I said, with all my sage wisdom, they'll never elect an American.
I said
Everyone's
the same.
Playing that back to me now, you know. So, no, we didn't think that was going to happen.
Yeah, but it did. Why do you think they chose an American?
You know, I think they chose the man, really.
Yeah.
I mean, you look at him and you see this range of experience. Administrator, canon lawyer, pastoral ministry, now dicastery experience, curial experience. I think when they saw that, and also him, I know him a little bit from the two synods. I was with
him. Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you. I know you spent time with him.
Yeah, the last two Octobers, and the first time I met him, I went up to him and I said, oh, hello. I think he was cardinal by then, Your Reverence. Yeah. You just got a big job. Head of the dicastery. Right. Little did I know a bigger job was coming. But, you know, he's from Chicago. We grew up about 25 minutes from each other. He's only a few years older than I, so really from the same world in Chicago. So he's a good man. He's a soft-spoken, kind of self-contained, prayerful person. I think they saw all of that, and they elected him.
Well, look, he was only a cardinal for 2 years,
yeah, right.
and he's only been here in Rome for 3.
Yeah.
How does that pastoral experience in Peru, how will that shape the Pope that we're about to get a glimpse of?
Oh, I think a lot. You know, I mean, there he is the best of Pope Francis in him, the man that wanted to go to the margins, serve the hungry, the poor, the homeless. You know, the corporal works of mercy. His mm-hmm. life was all about that in a very dedicated way. I think it's interesting the last two popes have been religious. We have a Jesuit, now an Augustinian, and it gives a worldwide perspective, but also that, you know, basic commitment to the works of mercy, I think will certainly shape his papacy.
I want to show the audience a glimpse of the Sistine Chapel Mass this morning, where he opened in English, probably the first time in history we've ever heard had a pope pronounce a homily at its start in English. Watch.
Through the ministry of Peter, you have called me to carry that cross and to be blessed with that mission. And I know I can rely on each and every one of you to walk with me as we continue as a church, as a community of friends of Jesus, as believers, to announce the good news, to announce the gospel.
What did you think when you heard him say that particularly and the fact that it was being pronounced in American English?
Which is Chicago English.
Chicago, you know. Even better.
No, but you know what I like is that we talk about political positions and this and that strategy and so on. The Pope's job is to declare the resurrection. He's the successor of Peter. Peter came to Rome to declare the resurrection of Jesus from the dead. Mm. That's the Pope's job. So I love the fact that the first things he said basically are the gospel. And the gospel is not just vague velleities about the political life.
Yeah.
The gospel is good news, everybody. Jesus Christ rose from the dead. Mm. So that's the Pope's job, and that's the first thing he's done.
Yeah, there was one moment there where he invoked the martyrdom of St. Ignatius of Antioch during that homily. And Bishop, your thoughts on that aspect of the Petrine ministry, which we rarely talk about. I mean, this square that we sit in front of, this is where St. Peter himself was crucified upside down and then buried a few, like a mile further. But this is where it all happened. Connect the dots there for me.
I think about that all the time when I come here, this grand Renaissance piazza and everything. But, right, Peter was brutally put to death, probably just over that way, where the Circus of Nero was. They think the last thing he might have seen is that obelisk that's still here.
Yeah.
They dragged his body over to the Vatican Hill and threw him in the ground. It was remembered by the small Christian community all those centuries. That's Peter's witness. Mm. He gave his life to testify to the risen Christ, and that's the Pope's job. And it's a job unto death. It's a total dedication.
Yeah.
Peter, do you love me more than these?
Mm.
Yes, Lord, I do. Well, then feed my sheep. Peter, do you love me more than these? The 3 times the Lord compels Peter to say, yes, I love you. And, when you're a young man, you tied your own belt. When you're an old man, someone else will tie you up.
But
we saw exactly where they tied him up, right here.
Yeah.
So I think that should, in a positive way, kind of haunt the mind of every pope.
Yeah. Well, that's what I've been reminding people all week long. This isn't electing a prime minister or a president. Right. You are electing a successor of the apostle that's buried right here.
It's the most famous grave marker in the world. It's right behind us.
It's quite a grave marker. Yeah. Now, you've seen the reportage of Cardinal Prevost's tweets against Trump's deportation plans, some of his criticisms of J.D. Vance. Now, some are saying, aha, he's a woke pope. And then they find his voter registration, and it's Republican, yeah. And others are saying he's a MAGA pope.
Yeah.
Your thoughts on all of this?
I think he adopts Catholic social teaching, which teaches, for example, that a country can defend its borders, can maintain its borders, and should exhibit an openness to the migrant who's in need, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. How you work out the precise details of that, well, that's a matter of political debate.
Yeah.
But I think he represents Catholic social teaching, not either Democratic or Republican political positions. Mm-hmm. You know, look, he's a man that spent a lot of time in Latin America. I'm sure he's got a deep sympathy for those who have, you know, migrated to our country and all that.
Sure.
But no, I think it's Catholic social teaching and the name he chose, which to me is the most important thing we know right now about him.
Really?
Leo the 14th, clearly referencing Leo the 13th. It struck me, Raymond, that, you know, almost any other name of a, let's say, pope the last 100 years would have given away the game. You know, I'm John Paul III. Oh, I know what you're about. I'm Francis II.
Yeah.
The fact that he didn't choose Francis II, to me, is very interesting. Mm. He goes back over 100 years to Leo the 13th, the great father of the modern Catholic social teaching tradition, which is neither conservative nor liberal. It's not Democratic or Republican. I think that's very hopeful. That's a bridge-building move that he can make.
What if you had to give the Pope three must-do items starting now? What would those three items be? What's the most urgent need in the church today, Bishop? Well,
first, I would say you are the sign and symbol of the unity of the church. And so I go back to someone like Johann Adam Müller in the 19th century. Before you get to anything juridical and all that, the Pope's job is to symbolize in his own person the unity of the church. That's job one. Job two, I would say, evangelization. Now, I'm seeing it from a more Western standpoint. It's different in Africa, different in Asia a bit. But I would still say evangelization, the great call of Vatican II, Paul VI, John Paul II, Benedict, Francis, all of them. Evangelize, evangelize, evangelize. And then I'll get a little practical, I think, address the finances. And I think we might be underestimating the importance of that in the minds of the cardinals that elected him. They might be looking to this American, experienced in administration, ran the entire Augustinian order, maybe to help them get the finances straightened out.
That's what I'm hearing from some of the African cardinals and European cardinals, that because they got that report. I mean, $400 million in debt. That's just the pensions. $2 billion overall. That's a big hole to dig out of. What about the clarity of teaching? I mean, for the many blessings of Pope Francis, clarity of doctrine was not always his strong suit, because he would say one thing, which was correct, and then he'd turn around and do something else. What must the Pope do to sort of clean up and have a unified voice coming from Rome?
You know, I'm a John Henry Newman man. Newman felt that the Pope's job was to act as a kind of referee, that the life the church goes on, you know, serving the poor and then the life of prayer, the life of the intellectuals and so on. The Pope's job was occasionally to intervene to say, no, wait a minute, that's gone too far.
Right.
No, you can't do that. And like a good referee, then get back off the court or off the field and say, all right, play.
Yeah.
But to intervene clearly and decisively when he had to, I think that is a key papal responsibility.
Yeah.
If the referee isn't clear, that's why they wear black and white, by the way,
you know,
because their job is to be very clear. It's black or you're in or you're out.
Right.
It's fair or foul. If the Pope doesn't do that, we got some problem in the life of the church.
What about the synodal way? Do you think it'll continue? Should it continue in the way it was started?
Yeah, I was involved in it, you know, the two synods. I saw a lot of virtues in it. The fact that it brought, you know, the international church together. Mm-hmm. I like the fact that we were in conversation with each other. I like the fact, look, I'm a bishop of a diocese. Yeah. If I don't listen to a wide variety of people, I'll make bad decisions. Yeah. I'm having a synod in my diocese this coming summer.
Yeah.
All of that, I think, was good. My problem with the synod was we almost seemed allergic at times to making a decision. So it was a lot of table conversation. What's your point of view? What's your point of view? And here's what I think. And if there was a move to correct or let's move to judgment, that almost seemed out of bounds. I thought that was a problem.
Yeah.
So yes, to listen to a wide variety of voices, but we've got to be decisive too in what we teach.
Do you feel it diffuses the bishop's authority when you suddenly invite all of us in, and we all get a say, and there's two bishops at the table and 10 laymen?
We did worry about that. I mean, so part of Catholic ecclesiology is the bishop has this charism of teaching.
Right.
And, we think that's something distinctive. Yeah. So that did come in the minds of a lot of us at the Synod. Now, there are about 300 bishops there, maybe 100 non-bishops. Yeah. But still, we wondered about the nature of that gathering. Mm-hmm. If you have the 300 with the clear charism of teaching and the 100 who don't, but we all have the same vote.
Right.
That was an issue that some of us had. Yeah.
Well, we shall keep our eye on Pope Leo, and thank you for being here.
Right.
We'll talk to you in the days ahead.
God bless you, Raymond. Thanks.
La pace sia con tutti voi.
Joining me now with his analysis and perception of this American Pope, Leo XIV, is the President Emeritus of the Acton Institute, Father Robert Sirico. Welcome back.
Good to be with you.
Now, Father, before I jump into your thoughts on this papacy, give me a reflection on the world stopping for a moment and gazing upon this papal conclave and the Church itself. What does it say about the influence of Catholicism?
Well, it sure was better than the movie, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, the sets were more authentic.
Well, the 11th act, the payoff was a heck of a lot better.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
No, I think the drama, if I may use that term, of Catholicism, and the backdrop, the sets, that are so authentic. You know, they're not just Potemkin villages. All of this represents a certain flow of history that has an inevitability and an authenticity that is undeniable.
Yeah. Was an American on your radar, or did you believe, like the rest of us, no American could ever get elected?
Well, I was asked that several times, and I said no American could be elected because we are the most powerful and the richest country in the world, all of that stuff.
Yeah.
But I did say if they got into trouble, I could see them going for O'Malley because O'Malley was the least American. I didn't have Prevost on my radar, and he would be older, and so this would give the new cardinals time to get to know one another. But that beautiful analysis went right out the window.
So why do you think they did elect this particular American, Robert Prevost?
I think because he has both the genius of America, the organizing genius, the communicative genius.
Practicality.
Practicality. Probably has a good, sophisticated understanding of finance and markets and management, that kind of thing. But also he has that personal warm touch, the best of Francis in terms of people and vulnerability, human vulnerability. And I think if he can bring those two characteristics together, we're in for a very, very interesting pontificate, and a hopeful one.
Tell me what you thought about the optics of the scene we saw right here just yesterday. When the new pope emerged, he greeted the crowd, and he came out with Benedict XVI's crozier and that ornate mozzetta, that red cape, which was akin to Benedict XVI's debut, not Francis's, who had none of that.
Right.
The minimalism of Francis, is that over?
It looks like it is. It was a striking symbol, and I know a lot of people who wouldn't follow church stuff the way we do would miss it, but I pointed that out to several people. He knew this was going to be the first time the cardinals were going to see him as pope in the Sistine Chapel, because when we first came out, and then, of course, on the balcony. Now, I think the second shoe will drop when we hear if he decides to reside in the Apostolic Palace, which I predict he will.
Yeah, I think he will, too. Yeah. To show I certainly respect my predecessor, but...
Yeah. And I think there's going to be a lot of that over the course of this pontificate. He's going to affirm his predecessor and then deepen
And deviate and move in his own direction, which every pope has to.
Sure.
Father, tell me, how do you think this American pope will interface with President Donald Trump and his larger-than-life presence on the world scene? Some are saying this was a deliberate choice by the cardinals to, if you will, counter Trump, to temper American political influence. Do you buy that?
I could see that as part of the consideration, as part of the consideration as well, the whole financial crisis of the Vatican, because Americans and American business people were somewhat alienated by the things that he that Francis said, and how he will relate to Trump. I mean, if you wanted to be a conspiracy theorist, you would say that they planned the election for the very moment that Trump was announcing this very bigly deal in England, and he was blown off
out of the media.
Out of the media.
White smoke came up, and that UK-US deal.
Especially after having tweeted the image of himself as Pope.
But having an American from Chicago interface with Trump, there's something... when Trump engages with Americans, there's something, or just people in the Anglosphere, he's very different from anywhere else.
Yes.
I just think the communication between and Pope Leo will be different.
To speak with someone in one's own idiom, I think that Trump will understand him better. I think he will understand Trump. Trump thinks non-Americans are exotic. Maybe even his wife as well. But I don't think he communicates well with non-Americans, and I think he now has an opportunity to go to the world through this Pope if he can accept that filtering.
Yeah, and I keep thinking of John Paul and Reagan and that relationship. You know, they understood each other.
Well, that was a different thing altogether. But a Chicago boy and a New York boy, this is going to be very interesting.
We'll see what happens. How do you think Pope Leo will look upon the economic teachings of the church, particularly the free market aspect that you and JP, too, championed?
Yes. I'm very hopeful in this regard because of the selection of the name, Pope Leo, because Pope Leo XIII, of course, inaugurated Catholic social teaching, which is neither left nor right, but was developed and promulgated at the time of the communist advance against workers and the family. And I think, and by the way, Pope Leo has no connections that I've been able to find with liberation theology, despite having been in Peru, which is where Gutierrez, the father of liberation theology, was from. Despite that, no connections with that. That has to be a very deliberate choice on his part.
Yeah. Tell me about what needs to be done by Pope Leo vis-a-vis this China-Vatican pact, that secret pact that we've been reporting so extensively on. Of course, Cardinal Zen raised his voice in opposition to. I know you wrote a piece recently that Cardinal Zen should defect. I don't think he took your advice.
No, he didn't take my advice. Yeah. I thought he'd be a new Manzenti, you know.
But what should Pope Leo do about this Vatican-China pact?
Now, his personality isn't the personality of John Paul II. And he also isn't coming at it from the experience of John Paul with regard to fascism and communism. But I think his gentle, strong voice that identifies the problems not only in China, though primarily in China, but also in Nicaragua, in Venezuela, in Cuba, and other places where there is injustice, I think his voice can be added to that. With regard to the policy, the very fact that the Chinese government appointed two bishops during the interregnum at the death of the Pope, almost on the same day, tells you a lot about how seriously China takes that.
And an American looking at this and the way this is played out and the impact on the faith of the people there and people like Jimmy Lai, who is rotted in prison. What is it now? 8 years now?
Four years? It's three. It's three. And I just heard that President Trump is going to be involving that question in his negotiations with China.
Well, let us pray about that and pray that Pope Leo sees the light in that pact and maybe takes a different path.
I'm very hopeful here.
Me too. Father Robert Zurico, thank you as always for being here. That is all the time we have for now. Be sure to catch us next week. Until then, we'll be scouting the world over for all that is seen and unseen. On behalf of the staff and crew of EWTN News, thank you for watching. I'm Raymond Arroyo from Roma. Ciao.